You're listening to Back to the Light with J.D. Rieger. Hey everybody, welcome to yet another episode of Back to the Light. I'm your host, J.D. Rieger. With me is my friend and returning guest, Chris Milam. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have a new record out, or coming out very soon, right? Called Orchid South.
Yes, sir.
The single is out, the title track.
Right.
So you're here at the starting gate of the release of this record. How does it feel to finally be here?
Overdue. I guess we got the final master for this album back in the winter of 23, and that's just on the cusp of when, you know, once you start planning tours and promo and everything, it might be a fall release at that point. And I thought, well, let me give myself extra time before it comes out to like really do everything right and try to get all the pieces in place. So I've been kind of planning to this step for over a year now. Like you said, the album will come out in May, and I'll be touring nationally solo while that happens, like this spring and summer, and then I'll have the Memphis show on August 10th.
I want to talk a little bit about your journey to this record. When you texted me about doing this, you described Orchid South as the power pop LP of your dreams. How do you think that has eluded you previously?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. So before I started my first album, Kids These Days, and I want to say all three of my albums were cut with the same folks, the same studio here in Memphis, High Low Recording, and our overachieving pupil down front here, Toby Best, is the producer and collaborator of my dreams. So when I first started that album, Kids These Days, I kind of had a rough outline of maybe one day if the pieces fell into place, of a three album trajectory. Kids These Days is kind of about like one facet of my 20s. Meanwhile, the second album is about kind of one facet of my 30s. And then I thought it would be cool to go back as a third album and explore my adolescence. The reason that I waited till the third album to do that is because I think, like a lot of people, adolescence was a pretty painful time, and it took me a while to get enough perspective on it to feel like I could really write about it effectively, and honestly just like emotionally feel ready for the songs.
Was there any like emotional impetus, life inspiration that made you want to look back that way?
Yeah, it kind of happened naturally. So I'm pretty anti-nostalgia. And for better or worse, one way that I've dealt with those teenage years was once, you know, I was out of college and kind of entering adulthood, I just chose not to look back on them and didn't do that for a really long time. And then for some reason around, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, a lot of memories that I hadn't even thought about for a really long time started flooding back. And all of a sudden, experiences from back then that I was aware of but hadn't like really felt connected to, like those sense memories were just present all of a sudden. Like I could smell those rooms again. And I just gave that a lot of thought. I was like, what is it that all of a sudden like my teenage years are like really on my mind a lot now? And I think, without being a little too pointy-headed about it, when you're a kid, everything feels really heightened. At least it did for me. And my own like interior world was extremely emotional and extremely amplified at all times. I think what happened was that in recent years, the exterior world started to feel extremely turbulent and emotional at all times. And for some reason, those dots just like really connected for me. And so all of the songs on this album, if I did my job, debatable, if I did my job, all the songs on this album simultaneously tell like a really specific story of you know, time and place where I was in Memphis as a teenager, but also maybe has like an echo to the present and things that are happening now.
Talking about the songwriting phase of the record, I mean, one, how do you go about approaching putting these like memories and feelings that you're talking about into a pop song? And then two, I mean, I'm curious how long you spent writing before you decided you were ready to record it.
Yeah. Well, I'll take the second part first.
Sure.
Alex, I was writing the album. I mean, there's at least one song on this album that's 10 years old. I'm just always writing. And every artist kind of has a different process, but I'm the type who will just kind of stay writing, whether I'm feeling especially inspired or not. I kind of subscribe to the muse wants to find you working theory. So I'm always writing, and I always like have a back catalog of songs to kind of cull from when I want to put an album together. So the writing of this album took a long time, is the short answer. Now, what was the first one?
It was putting those memories of adolescence into a song.
In a pop song specifically, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's hard. It's hard to make anything a pop song, I think.
And anything can be a pop song, so
right.
That can make it both a challenge or completely freeing.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is, okay, it is really hard to write a hit. And allow me a tangent here. When I say hit, I mean organic hit, a song that becomes hugely popular by the merits of its song, or by the merits of itself as a popular song, not the latest single from an already massive artist. So it's really hard to make an organic hit. It is also really hard to make interesting, innovative art. But all of my heroes did both at the same time. And so that's always been my goal. Now, whether or not, I mean, it's an impossible needle to thread for a year, much less 40, like, you know, Dylan or somebody. But that's the goal for me every time out. And so the idea is to write a song that has a, supports as many listens as you want to give it. And you got to pack a lot into a short amount of time. And so Toby and I talked on all three albums, but especially this one because it is in a different genre as like kind of the singer-songwriter and Americana Fair of the first two, putting as much densely into a short amount of space as possible. And that just comes with like rewriting. I'm a big advocate of let the inspiration hit, just get it all on a page till your heart's content, but rewrite, 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 and just like keep folding that samurai blade over and over and over again until it's just, you know, impossibly dense and indestructible type of thing.
That sort of leads me to, I wanted to talk about some of the musical influences that are, you know, referenced in your bio and that we've talked about privately. Big Star, R.E.M. and Gin Blossoms being, you know, primarily, you know, the big three among those. And,
right.
You know, I'm curious how those influences kind of made their way into shaping this record.
Sure. You know, some of that is the stuff that I was listening to at the time. So, you know, when I was a teenager growing up here in Memphis, show of hands, how many people remember 96X, the radio station, which is recently resurrected? A little different, but same idea. But that was your modern rock alternative here in Memphis, Tennessee in the early and mid and late 90s. And they played kind of all like the grunge of the era, but then everything that kind of shot out from that. And that included kind of neo power pop at the time, which was Gin Blossoms, R.E.M. You know, they had like the early R.E.M., but also through like Monster and everything. And like Monster was it for me. That was a massive record.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but in listening to Orchid South, I was thinking that there were a lot of, that it would have been a great record, and I mean no offense by this. It would have been awesome if it came out in like 1989 or 90. Like pre-grunge would have been the sweet spot for this record.
No, totally. I mean, that's honestly what I was aiming for. My goal is to make something that would have been popular 40 years ago.
Yeah.
It keeps the lights on, y'all. But so I kind of came by that, those influences, honestly. I mean, that's very much like the stuff that I was learning to play on guitar when I picked up a guitar for the first time. And so anytime I make a song, much less an entire album, I ask myself three questions. One, what do you want to say? Two, why do you want to say it? And three, how do you want to say it? And so for this album, it was important to me, for me to not only write about my adolescence, but the how was, you know, do it using those influences and those inspirations and those sounds, like the, you know, actual guitar tones and everything. Like, we got really specific about how this record should be executed beyond just the writing itself.
Well, let's talk about the person you made it with.
Yeah, please.
Toby Vest.
Absolutely.
And High Low. Well, what brought you to Toby originally? I know you guys have been working together since like 2017, or
yeah,
the record you first made came out then.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was linked up with Toby from John Miller at Shangri-La Records. We were just hanging out one night, and I was talking about my next project and kind of feeling a little rudderless when it came to what type of producer I should work with. And he was a huge fan of Toby and Toby's brother Jake's bands. And also, and I actually knew their one of their bands, Tiger High, that I was also a huge fan of, but I didn't know that Toby was a producer and like that they have their own studio, which used to be just down the road. And they kicked y'all out to form a empty space with a huge sign for lease. Memphis, everybody. But so John linked us up, and I went in with the songs for kids these days, but we talked about just doing one single initially, which was Tell Me Something I Don't Know. And I knew as soon as like our first conversation that finally I was speaking the same language as someone in the music world. And I mean, I just cannot say enough about how much my relationship with Toby and also Pete Matthews, who engineered all three albums and has mixed all three albums. The two of them are High Low Recording, but beyond the two of them, there's kind of like a family of musicians that have worked on a ton of projects out of there. And I very much have that family of musicians on my album. I see some of them in the crowd. Some, believe it or not, have gigs at the moment. But so, you know, Sean Zorn drummed on Meanwhile and Orchid South. And we have Mark Edgar Stewart, who isn't with us tonight, played bass on Orchid South. Luke White, who we simply don't have the time or the bandwidth for me to talk about tonight, but he's my number one draft pick on every project I ever made. And Luke's just a wonderful person, but a truly special talent.
Agreed.
And Steve Salvage also played guitars. And we had Mark Franklin, who's in the back, where the cool kids are, and our Edmiston playing horns on the record. The absolutely indispensable Rick Steff on keys, and Rick does a lot of stuff at High Low as well. And then kind of the same crew has sung with me for the last couple records, which is Luke, again, and Abby West Pates, who's with us this evening, and she's maybe my favorite voice in Memphis. And Brendan Valines, who's being cool in California, whatever.
I want to direct you back to Toby specifically, if that's cool. And like, I can hear him sighing in the crowd.
I knew I should have sat in the back.
Well, I mean, this is, I feel like this is a clumsy question, but why is it you think you guys have jived so well together over the years? Like, what is the musical connection between you? How was that formed?
Yeah, I mean, it's a couple things off the bat. Like, first of all, Toby's really thoughtful about what he does. And I'm very thoughtful about what I do. I'm not saying the end result is good, but I put a lot of time and energy and forethought into what I'm doing. And so when I was talking with Toby about not only what I wanted kids these days to be, but why, and like kind of giving context for how we might be able to execute it, I never felt like I was just running my mouth. You know, he always not only understood what I was going for, but had specific ideas for how to get there. But another thing, just off the top, I mentioned earlier that I was a huge fan of their band Tiger High. And one of the reasons I was a huge fan of that band was because the way that they would kind of combine garage rock and psychedelia, and there were all these like sounds on those records. I was like, how'd they make that sound? And so when, with kids these days, there's a song called All of Our Ghosts. And I remember saying, you know, I would like a sound at the top of this song that is almost like a, you know, like you're picking up a CB radio, but like played backwards or something. And then like, I went to pick up beer and came back. He's like, something like this. I was like, Jesus Christ, like, how did you do that? I mean, they're just, he and Jake both are just so unbelievably talented when it comes to making abstract ideas concrete reality.
Who was it that dictated that this record would rock harder?
I mean, that was me. Yeah, that was me.
How involved was Toby in helping you like realize that?
Oh, hugely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the initial demos, I wanted it to be a rock record. But in terms of how to get there, you know, I'm lost without the folks at Hilo. Yeah.
Can you play a song?
I probably can.
which one do you want to play first?
Yeah, let me do, I'll do the first single off the album that came out, actually, this one came out back in the fall. I fight the arm, so you're all gonna have to bear with me here. Yeah, so this is the first single off the album. It's called Cut Myself Shaving. Myself shaving, the bleeding didn't stop for hours. I cut myself shaving, nobody ever taught me how. I miscommunicated, I'm dead silent, I gotta scream. I miscommunicated, I can't even tell you what I mean. Oh yeah, can you hear me now? My mind's windows all painted shut, try asphyxiating, but something always gets me up. I'm emaciated till there's nothing left. I cut myself shaving till the scars connect. Oh yeah, can you see them now? Now I'm feeling fine. Jesus Christ, and now I'm feeling fine. Until the next one. Jesus Christ, and now I'm doing fine. Until the next one. Jesus Christ, and now I'm doing fine. I cut myself shaved. And we're back.
Yes. It's tough for me to ask, but tell me a little bit about writing that song and what inspired it specifically.
Sure. Well, one day I cut myself shaving, and so I've actually been growing this beard for about 6 months. I don't have to shave very often, and when I do, I always cut myself. So, I mean, literally, like, that's, you know, kind of something that always happens to me, and I got to thinking about that. But combine that with the fact that, like, you know, I say at one point in the song, I guess the first line, nobody ever taught me how. That's true. Nobody ever taught me how. So it kind of starts linking back to experiences as a teenager. But specifically, I mean, it's about first experiments with self-harm and kind of my journey with that.
Well, you know, it hits you in the chest when you hear that song. So, and it's a great song. It's great.
Thank you.
You know, it's powerful that you can put that with, you know, such a poppy, you know, a heavy theme with a poppy melody. It's not something not everyone can do.
Well, I appreciate it. Hopefully the whole album kind of does that. That was the goal.
You kind of already shouted out the people who helped you make the record, but is it cool if we go back through some of them?
Yeah, please.
I kind of had this idea that we could mention each person by name and maybe talk about, you know, how they contributed to the record or something cool.
Yeah.
You know, maybe from a specific song that they did, whatever comes to mind,
right.
Really. So we'll just go in order. We'll start with Sid Selvage. Steve Selvage.
Actually,
it'd be cool if the ghost of Sid was on your record. But
my only connection to Sid was that at the old like radio station that was like Kevin Cubbins would work out of and Sid when he was still alive would work out of downtown. I was waiting on Cubbins to show up for something. And there was a ukulele sitting in the waiting room, and I just started playing the ukulele while I was waiting, and someone came and said, "That's Sid Selvage's ukulele. Put that down." I mean, I couldn't disagree. But no, Steve Selvage is on the album. Some of y'all, I'm sure, know Steve Selvage. I mean, he's kind of Memphis music royalty. He's one of the best guitar players alive, and we're very lucky to have him.
The Hold Steady, Sons of Mudboy,
right?
Big ass truck,
exactly.
Tons of bands,
and yeah, he's played on Meanwhile and Orchid South. We were lucky to have him. I'll give you one. I was actually texting with Steve about this morning. So on this album, there's a cover of Phantom Planet's song called "Always on My Mind." And I always thought that was like one of the best songs the Beatles never wrote. It's just an impossibly cool and gorgeous pop song. And I was like, well, I kind of always had like a different version in mind that I thought might be a little bit more like Big Star. And so we did that. And then there's like, this isn't on Phantom Planet's version, but I built in the solo section. And so it kind of does a space for solo, space for solo. Which is like a really like kind of old school rock trope. And so he had like these little spotlight solo sections, and I thought that he would do just fireworks, you know, just Steve Selvage, like just...
Sure, guns blazing.
Guns blazing. And he did this weird kind of false start, tripping over its own dick type of solo thing. And when he did that, I was like, what is happening here? I don't know why that... And after we did the take, he was like, you know, that's basically inspired by some old Van Halen song that I didn't know. And he was like, I was listening to your version of this, Chris, and I had this demo, and I was thinking of Van Halen. So I just wanted to try this. So it's like kind of like that Van Halen riff. I'm like, cool. And I thought, well, we'll just do a couple more takes and use the other takes. And but when we listened back to it, I was like, oh, God, that's actually perfect for the song. So when the album comes out, or you purchase one this evening, when you get to Always On My Mind, listen for Steve's choice for the solo section, because this song's like so kind of fast paced and a little bit obsessive and like dark, but like very rocking, and like it's just breakneck speed. And so when all of a sudden it has like this spotlit, here we go for the big moment, Guitar Hero, I think it's great that like it just stumbles over itself. Like, that's true to my teenage experience. Like, he actually understood the song a little bit better than I did in that moment.
You know, I had him play on something for me once, and I kind of wanted the guns blazing thing, and then he ended up doing something really melodic, and so
right.
I was like, oh, that's cool. I wanted the guns blazing.
Like, I could have done that, guy.
Let's talk about Luke White, who is here.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Snow Globe, Spiral Woo! Stairs. He's been with you since Kids These Days, right?
Yes, yeah. Luke's been the MVP of all three of my albums, I would say. He plays guitars on all three albums. He sings on all three albums.
Is it him doing like the Peter Buck sounding guitar stuff, or is that somebody else?
Right. So the opening notes of Orchid South, the title track that came out last week, is a 12-string Rickenbacker, and anytime you hear that on the album, that's Luke. And so I guess like one
I thought that was you.
One little morsel I can give you about Luke specifically, and just kind of like behind the scenes process stuff, is that it's a power pop record with some kind of garage rock in there too. And so we were talking about like guitar tones and sounds that we wanted, and we're like, well, you know, if it's power pop, like you kind of want that 12-string sound in there. And so we outsourced a 12-string Rickenbacker, which is, to me personally, like the most beautiful instrument in all of rock music. And so this amazing instrument was at our disposal, and Luke was playing that in the sessions. But it's a hard instrument to kind of wrangle sometimes. You got
to
be like
in tune.
You read my mind, because we were tracking as a full band. Like the core of these songs was just us playing in a room, and Luke was often playing the Rick. And it's, first of all, just hard to kind of play that guitar consistently, like with precision. Like it's just a little bit of a finicky instrument. But between every single take, you gotta tune it. And so I would say like, what, 90% of the 10% of the recording budget went to recording, and 90% went to Luke tuning the guitar between tracks. But, you know, he slayed the dragon. That was all him.
Let's talk about Rick Steff.
Yeah.
Who most people, I guess, or many people know from Lucero, among right. other numerous projects.
Right.
How did he get involved?
Rick, I first worked with Meanwhile, my second album. Toby brought him in. Rick's on just... almost all of the Hi-Lo projects. I mean, he's on a ton of those albums. I'd known Rick in Lucero for ages, and he's another like just kind of Memphis music Hall of Famer. He's amazing. But he came in for Meanwhile, and that's a really pretty stripped back album, and Rick's really present on that one. And in the span of a day, basically, he completely transformed the project. But in addition to, he's one of these guys who isn't just a spectacular musician, he gets the song. He can do all the fireworks, but so often he's just gonna like hang back or just play three notes. Like on Song of the Summer, the last track on this album, he's barely doing anything, and it's just pitch perfect for the song and so sparse and gorgeous. But in addition to his work on the tracks themselves, I have a pretty strict no asshole policy. And Rick is the like for someone who could be a diva, given his CV and talent, he's the sweetest. He is the most generous. He's so encouraging. He's just a guy that you want in the room.
Let's talk about the horns.
Yeah.
Art Edmiston and Mark Franklin.
Yeah.
Those guys also well-established.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's Memphis horns, right? That's people come from all over the globe for Memphis horns, and we are very lucky to have them here. Those two guys are, you know, just A-listers when it comes to horn players. They do amazing work. They've played with everybody. I will say that I knew that this album would be power pop with three-part harmony and horns. And when I told my mom that, she was like, cool, this will be the first album of yours I actually like. It's just like, you could put a garbage truck backing up on a record, and if it had horns on top of it, mom would be like, yes, it's the best. Just all horns all the time. So, no, it, they were wonderful, and they came in with so many ideas for every song. Like, we kind of had to make choices in terms of what we were keeping because they gave us so much.
Mark Edgar Stewart, who was recently on the podcast in January or February, whenever that was, played bass. He's mostly known as a songwriter in town these days, but played bass on your record.
Right.
You play on the whole thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he played on the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, I've known and been a fan of Mark for over 10 years now. In fact, when I moved back here from New York, the first show I played at the old High Tone, Mark actually opened up for me. And you were on that bill.
Was I?
I think so, man.
You know, the three of us also played at River Arts Fest together.
That's true. That was cold as hell.
Yes, yes, it was.
It could be 80 and I'm cold as hell, but that day was, like, legit cold. But I've always...
Maybe you should button your shirt.
Oh, man. This is buttoned, isn't it? No, but I've been such a huge fan of Mark as a songwriter for a long time, but I was aware of the fact that, like, he, back in the day, like, he started as a kind of ace bass player for a lot of bands in town, and so I always had in mind, like, if the project presented itself, I'd love to just have Mark play bass with me. He's another guy, like, he's good to have in the room, you know? He's just such a sweetheart.
And you said ace bass, not ace of bass.
Wait for the next one, man.
Just to clarify. And then Sean Zorn, the drummer, also.
Yeah.
I know he plays for Amy Levere and tons of other people.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, we were really lucky to have Sean. So Sean played on Meanwhile as well, which, like I said, was like a very kind of Americana stripped back record. And frankly, blame my own ignorance, I'd mostly seen Sean play with like other singer-songwriters in town and do kind of like, you know, softer sets. And so when I was talking with Toby about filling out the band for this album, which is like a rock album, I was like, you know, I love Sean, but I've never seen him do rock stuff. And Toby's like, that was like the first 10 years of his career was like, he's like a metal drummer. I was like, oh shit. Okay. Well, yeah, let's call up Sean. And sure enough, I mean, he was absolutely perfect. I say Luke was the MVP of the sessions, but there were days where Sean was absolutely the MVP of the sessions. So going back to the Phantom Planet cover that I mentioned earlier, if you listen to the original and then listen to my version, it's so much faster. And like I said, we're just cutting live, like as a band. And so while everybody else, we rehearsed a lot, but we were still finding it on day of recording and, you know, doing more than one take. And that song is breakneck speed and not easy and has like a lot of little changes and ins and outs and fills. And he knew the original, like, has this one kind of like iconic fill, and he was like right there with that. So Sean was perfect while we were cutting, Always on My Mind, and everybody else was not. And and we were all like, okay, one more. And you just hear Sean like sigh into the mic. He's like, oh, God. One more. Yeah, we can do it.
Long as you get it on drums, you can fix anything else.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true. We're still, I think, fixing my parts on Orchid South, but yeah.
Orchid South, remind me the release date in May?
May 10th.
You're essentially putting this out yourself, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about the challenges of promoting yourself and distributing a record on your own. I mean, it's a challenge that I know well.
Yeah.
But, I mean, from your perspective, you know, what's it like?
You gotta wear a lot of hats, basically do a lot of jobs that you don't really love doing or aren't necessarily your strengths. I mean, some people just put stuff on Spotify and move on. Honestly, there's a part of me that's like a little envious of that. I'm just not wired that way. I'm a touring artist also, so like, you know, I have to book those tours, and that takes months of kind of legwork and advance work. So first of all, you got to set up all the tour schedule. But in addition to that, press needs 3-4 months lead time. Actually getting the vinyl press needs a lot of, you know, advance notice. Graphic design, we have Josh Breeden in the house tonight, who did the graphic design for the album, the artwork. And just also just kind of like making a marketing plan, which, you know, back in the day was my day job. So,
That's the thing I wanted to get into, because, you know, these people who write about music and, you know, radio programmers, whatever, they're getting bombarded with emails from publicists and independent right. artists, like, you know, dozens, if not hundreds a day. So how do you make yourself stand out?
I send nudes. honestly, I'm very meticulous about kind of keeping track of everybody I've met along the way. And so, you know, being my own publicist for this album, a lot of it was just reconnecting with people who have written up the albums in the past. I have like a literal database that I keep and keep updating. So like that's for press alone. But I mean, also it's just beyond like those kind of like virtual connections, because a lot of these people I've never met in person. A lot of the people I have, like, over the years touring. And so it's just a lot about, like, oh, I remember that sound guy from Richmond in 2015, but now he's a talent buyer at this other club, you know, and he'll give me, you know, a show at this venue that I have no business playing, type of deal.
Something I talked about with Mark on his episode is kind of the unfortunate nature of the album release cycle, how we... As artists, we pour our hearts and soul into making these things for months or years, even sometimes. And then it comes out and you get a few weeks of press and it's over in a flash.
Yeah.
So how do you fight against, like, how do you keep the record staying relevant and in people's, you know, ears and eyes?
Is Mark still putting stuff out on Mad Jack?
I don't know for sure. He was sort of vague.
Okay.
When we talked about it. So I'm uncertain.
Well, I've heard Mark talk about that many times over the years, and Mark's release plan has been the same over the years. So listen, I'm not speaking out of turn. I've said this to him at India Palace a dozen times.
Shots fired.
If you want something different to happen, change something. But
well, I mean, I'm not just speaking for him in this case. I mean, I find it a challenge for, you know. I just put out a record in late 2022,
sure.
And you know, now it's, you know, it's kind of a bummer because it's over.
No, totally, and I hear what you're saying, because all three of my albums have come out early in the year for exactly that reason. As soon as the calendar turns to the next year, it's considered an old record.
Yeah.
So all of them have been, you know, spring-ish releases, and then just tour as much as possible in that calendar year, and you have a new album out still. Because January 1st, 2025, what do you got for me now? But I mean, touring helps a lot. And I know that different artists have different home situations, and you know, that's, they're not going to be able to be on the road that much.
Yeah.
I'm just going to be working the road very hard this year, and hopefully that'll just kind of keep some momentum going.
Do you want to talk about some of the stuff you have set up?
Yeah, sure.
What do you have set up?
So I'm going to do Coast to Coast solo tour from April 17th in Seattle through like July 4th back down south. And then I'll have like a little time off. And then I'm second half of the year, I'm doing full band stuff, which will be, you know, a better reflection of the album as a whole. And so that'll be like closer to home, starting with the Memphis show August 10th. And then there'll be a Little Rock in the mix, and an Atlanta in the mix, and Birmingham in the mix, and couple others, I think.
That's actually something I meant to ask you about, is the challenge of, you know, translating these songs, which are, you know, rockers on the record, and now you're going to go out and play them just you and a guitar.
Right.
Is that difficult?
Depends on the song, yeah. Some of them I can kind of do like the unplugged treatment,
yeah.
And it works. Like, I think I kind of found a sweet spot with Cut Myself Shaving. It's, you know, if everybody was here with me, it would have a different weight to it, but I think there's a solo version that works. But I do give that a lot of thought, yeah. And I mean, some of them, JD asked me before we got going if one of the songs I was going to play tonight was the title track that just came out, Orchid South, and I was like, you know, that might need to wait for the band. And some BGVs. It's got such a big BGV anthemic chorus, and I'd like Luke and Abby and anyone and everyone to sing that with me instead, just all by myself.
What do you want to play, if not the title
yeah.
track?
We can just do Stairway and call it a night, right?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Let me think here. Well, this one is definitely a singer-songwriter track, so this one's easy. I mentioned this song earlier while talking about the keyboardist Rick Steff and how beautiful his work on this song was. The whole album takes place in my teenage years. It's written from that time and place. And that's 10 songs. And then the album kind of ends, and then there's like an epilogue. And that's more of kind of a singer-songwriter thing, fast forward to present day. And it kind of writes about that time with a different perspective. And so that song, The Summer, if we got a minute, I can talk a little bit more about the song itself.
Yeah. It's your show, man.
Y'all doing okay? Do we need to just throw beers at you? Just pour it down your gullet. So I was thinking a lot about, if I say the phrase song of the summer, do you know what I'm talking about? Like when I was growing up, you know, in top 40 was a little bit more omnipresent. If you, like, people would talk about, like, it was in the press a lot, what is the song of the summer this year? And so, I mean, like, you know, Genie in a Bottle was Once Upon a Time, or Call Me Maybe was Once Upon a Time. But it's the type of thing where you're just walking down the beach and you hear the same song played on 12 different boomboxes, you know? And so I was thinking about that and, you know, listen, my stuff's on streaming. I stream, I make my own playlists. But like with all technology, like something good comes with it and something bad comes with it. And I was just thinking a lot about whether or not I liked the particular song of that summer. I always appreciated the fact that it was in everybody's life and it was a shared experience that everybody had. And I feel like we just have fewer of those in recent years. You know, now if you walk down that beach, you're going to hear 12 different boomboxes playing 12 different Spotify playlists. So anyway, I thought it might be a good cap to the album about then versus now. This is a song of the summer. Days were long, shadows tall, you were mine till the fall of home. Beer on the trampoline, 40 rolls in the trees, And the cops came around the bend, and we climbed into the truck and gunned her. And the wind kissed your voice, singing out the song of the sun. Swore to a life that you've worn in, is it wearing you out? Swore that the world would know your name, have you changed it by now? Oh, now. The lightning splits the room, and you count until you hear the thunder. And the rain on your roof sounding like the song of the sun. What's left to share a song with you? We've drifted apart. A melody we ain't heard before, but we know it by heart. Cause now I know that I loved you like I love no other. And I'm getting old, dreaming about the song of the summer. Ooh. Na 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 na.
That concludes my prepared questions. Does anybody in the crowd have a question for Chris? Anybody at all?
Yeah, we wanted to save a little bit of time for anything, if y'all had anything. In the meanwhile, I can play, y'all asked for like kind of like a bonus song or whatever. So think about if you have any questions for me. It is like a one of one moment for you, because in life I don't really answer questions earnestly, but tonight you can ask me anything.
And does that apply to family members who want to like dig deep into your like personal? Just curious.
Do not encourage.
Is it music only?
Do not encourage them.
Well, can I do a quick sign off and then you can do whatever you want to do?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks everybody for having me. Thanks to the Memphis Listening Lab. Thanks to Engineer Eric. Thanks to Jared and the Simpletones for the theme music. And thanks to Chris Milam. Let's hear it one more time.